You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the current impeachment inquiry is causing a lot of people to think back to the only other times we've seen something like this in American history. We'll talk to a historian who says that may not be as helpful as we think. Now, you might know Professor Mike Leckrone as the longtime director of the UW Marching Band. He retired from that position recently after 50 years at the helm, but he's still sharing his love of music. He's teaching a course about the big band era through the UW-Madison Division of Continuing Studies. It starts next week. You can find info on how to register at continuingstudies.wisc.edu. Mike Leckrone joins us in the studio now. Mike, thanks so much for coming up.
Oh, Rob, I'm pleased to be here. Really am.
Well, take us to the big band era. What is the time period we're really talking about with the heyday of the big bands?
Well, the real heyday occurred in the 30s. Remember, everybody thinks of the 30s as the big band era, but because that's in 1935. That's when Benny Goodman got started and the Carnegie Hall concert came shortly later. But it really started really before that. I mean, you go back to the time of Duke Ellington, Paul Whiteman. That was in the 20s, and that's where bands started being almost, you'd say, a headliner in theaters, on stage, everywhere they could go. So it goes back really into the beginning of the 30s, and it lasted until about 1945. And then after the war, singers started to take over all of the pop music charts at that time.
And it seems our two jobs kind of lined up there. The real heyday, the rise of the big bands, came along with the rise of radio. How important was them coming in at the same time?
Well, radio was very important because in the earliest days, a performer had to appear on the radio to get any notice at all, because there wasn't the recording industry that we have now. And then when recordings came in after radio, then radio became even more important so far as the bands were concerned, because that's where all the discs, that's where all the recordings got out. The disc jockeys started to take over and do a lot. So the radio and the era of the big bands really coincided almost exactly at the same time.
Before we start listening to some music, I want to talk about the range of music, because it seems like you've got stuff that was almost like the punk rock, like a lot of improvisation to really heavily orchestrated stuff, swingy dance tunes to slow dance tunes. We're talking about a lot of different types of music, right?
Right. When people ask me what was a big band, I usually use three or four criteria. First of all, they had to have more than seven people.
had to be big.
Yeah, it had to be big. And some people say, well, seven isn't very big, but you have to have enough people that you can have sections. You can't just have solo instruments playing, because then it's kind of like a jazz combo at that point. But if you've got more than seven people, you almost by necessity have to have sections. And then they have to play written arrangements or things that are heavily arranged so that it sounds the same every time. A lot of people use what they call head arrangements at that time. And then the third element is dancing. You've got to be able to dance to this early music, and that's where it really got most of its impetus at that point.
We are talking about the music of the big band era. Mike Leckrone is with us, longtime band director at UW-Madison. He's teaching a course on the topic now. Well, let's hear some music, and I want to start with a name you mentioned, Duke Ellington and his orchestra, Don't Mean a Thing.
Don't mean a thing if you ain't got that swing.
It don't mean a thing, all you gotta do is swing.
I think you've got a whole section of the class just on Duke Ellington. You could probably do a whole class Ellington.
You could do a year on Duke Ellington, yeah, because he was such an important figure in American music. I think some people say Duke Ellington was American music at one point. That's a quote that is often used. But he started so many things, and he started in an era where it was just coming, jazz was just coming out of the districts where people didn't really like to consider it nice music. It was music that was, you know, played in all sorts of areas, the bars and so forth, and said it had a bad reputation. But Ellington started to make a little bit more of a, I guess you'd say, a concert appearance. It became not just music for the bars, not just music for dances and so forth. It became highly personalized music. And I think when you listen to Ellington, everything that he did had that flavor of Duke Ellington. You couldn't miss his band for anybody.
And I want to give a listen to Paul Whiteman, a song called Happy Feet, before we talk about Paul Whiteman and his orchestra. I think you've got another section in your class
on him too,
this is a whirlwind tour here. We only have a little bit of time. Paul Whiteman and his orchestra. understand there was some controversy over Paul Whiteman declaring himself the king of jazz.
Well, yeah, and Whiteman was also always very clear to point out he didn't give himself that connotation.
Okay. That was given to him.
It was given to him by some of his fans and some of his promoters, but he accepted it. I think he didn't turn his back on it. But he was, the king of jazz. A lot of people said, well, what he play isn't jazz. But there again, we get into whether that's a definition that you want to follow or I want to follow, because jazz has just so many different areas. And this is music was highly arranged, very carefully arranged. And so there wasn't a lot of room for the soloist to get up. And I think there's a feeling for a lot of people when you hear jazz, you're hearing improvised solos. But with Whiteman, you didn't get too much of the improvisation. I think an argument for the Whiteman band as being a jazz band is the guys who wrote the arrangements were highly trained jazz musicians, and so they wrote things in that flavor of the time. So it was music that had was one time removed from actually being performed extemporaneously.
Well, this is the kind of argument you could have with any type of music. It's like, is it jazz for decades? Yeah. Is this really rock? Is this really classical music? A lot of the arguments we have over any kind of music, they happen with the big band era too.
Well, yeah, and the big band era, one of the things that I find very interesting about it is the only time, I think, in American popular music that jazz was the popular idiom. When you get to a little later periods, jazz loses some of its popularity to rock and roll. And the fact is, there was a short period of time where it was country western would probably be considered the American music. But with jazz, it had that short period of time from, say, 35 to 45, where it was what everybody thought of as American popular music.
Oh, and it made it into the movies, too. We've got a clip of Cab Calloway here in the movie Stormy Weather, 1943, I think. Here's a listen. So this is the pinnacle of not just music culture, but pop culture in a lot of ways, too.
Right. And you know, Cab Calloway sometimes overlooked because he was such a pop figure. I mean, he was this jive guy that got on the radio and talked jive talk, and he was really a character. And so a lot of what he did musically was lost because he was considered more almost a caricature of what a jazz musician should have been at the time. But he was really quite good, and if you listen to some of his vocals, they have the same kind of spontaneous contemporary jazz that you would expect at the time.
That's interesting. I've heard the same argument made over a Louis Armstrong. He was such a character, and people focused on the character, and I think it was when the commemorative stamp came out, music people were really glad they showed him actually playing the trumpet.
Right.
They showed him as a musician, not just as a celebrity.
Right. He had become a pop figure because of some of times it's just his singing, because he was singing pop songs that had made it to the hit parade. I mean, he had a big tune on Hello Dolly back in the 60s, and people looked at him as that kind of a figure as opposed to what he was, which is a giant in the area of jazz.
I want to bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. We've got Nancy with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I'm calling to tell you that my father arranged music for Paul Whiteman. My father was sent to a seminary in Cincinnati when he was 9 years old. His mother proclaimed that he should be a priest. So he stayed at the seminary for many, many years, but never took any vows, got out, started a band because he had received a wonderful music education at this seminary, started a band, and eventually got in contact with Paul Whiteman and started arranging his music. My father's name was Leon Matthew, and I'm sure that your guest probably has seen his name on old sheet music.
I have seen the name, yeah.
Nancy, thank you so much. Wow, what a story. I guess he did find his calling after all. Can you talk about, that reminds me, the role of the composer and arranger, because Duke Ellington had, Billy Strayhorn writing music with him.
Billy Strayhorn wrote a lot of things. He was sort of what we might more... scholastically call an amanuensis, because he would sometimes Ellington would even call him on the phone and say, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and uh-huh. Strayhorn would write it down. Duke had his own talent, and he was very careful to most of the time, and I'll put that most of the time, credit all those people. I mean, if you see a tune that Billy Strayhorn wrote, Take the A Train, right. for example, that's credited solely to Billy Strayhorn, who probably Ellington did some of the work on it, but I think it was at a time when Ellington was feeling very generous and felt like, well, some of these royalties should go to Strayhorn, who was so helpful in what he did.
Thanks a lot for that call and that yes. story. Appreciate it. We're talking to Mike Leckrone. He's with us to talk about a continuing education class he's teaching about the big band era. You might also know him as the longtime director of the UW Bands and the UW Marching Band. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of the big band era, whether you grew up with it or just discovered it in your youth in this era? Who are your favorite performers, favorite songs? Call 800-642-1234. Or, hey, there are still big bands out there. Are you in one of them? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the big band era with Mike Leckrone. The former UW Marching Band director is teaching a class at the UW-Madison Division of Continuing Studies. It starts next week. You can find info on how to register at continuingstudies.wisc.edu. You can call in now, too, at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Mike about big bands and the big band era, or do you want to share your own favorite performer, song, singer, you name it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mike, we came in with Woody Herman there, a big Wisconsin connection
Wisconsin,
on that one.
Wisconsin kid, born in Milwaukee, and did most of his formative years in that Milwaukee area playing, and he was billed often as the boy wonder of the clarinet, but he also tap danced, he sang, and this was as a kid when he was in junior high school and high school, and so he has great Wisconsin connection, and then became one of the biggest names in the big band era.
Was Wisconsin a hot place for big bands, or were we just kind of a stopover?
No, I think Milwaukee. If you look at the history of Milwaukee, you'll see that a lot of the big bands made their home there. Plus, this was a great place. You say it a stopping place, but it was also a very important opportunity for people to play if they were going to Chicago or coming out of Chicago. So by its very nature, Wisconsin has a huge history in the development of big bands, and their former dance halls all over the state that can claim that so-and-so performed here in Madison in McFarland, the Park Ponderosa for many years was up into the 80s and 90s. It was a pretty hotbed for bands that were touring still and playing.
I wanted to bring up a race. This is a segregated era through most of the United States. Some bands were segregated. Occasionally, some weren't. Can you talk about how that all went?
Well, most of the bands at this point were segregated. When they did break the color line, as I used to say, it was often big news. The one who probably did it the most dramatically was Benny Goodman when he broke the color line with his Teddy Wilson and some of the other people that Lionel Hampton, and that broke that immediately. You saw white musicians and black musicians playing together on stage, and that was a very, very important step. The interesting thing is it didn't cause much consternation. The audiences at that point were so engrossed with the big band period that they just accepted the fact that these musicians were going to learn to play together, and it came off without too much of a difficulty. There were other instances. You mentioned Count Basie, and Count Basie at different times would hire singers that didn't look black enough, as they would say. They would have to make them up so that they would look more fitting into the part. And even Duke Ellington, there was a man named Juan Tizel who was Cuban, and they had to make Juan Tizel up to look darker when he would appear on stage. So that was the kind of times that we were going through. Gradually, that the musicians felt that they broke down a lot of those color lines so that they disappeared. And you mentioned earlier Duke Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong toured for many years with Jack Teagarden, who was a white musician, and they played on stage many, many times and without any concern at all about it.
Let's go back to our callers now. Larry is with us in New Berlin. Larry, hi.
Hi. Great talk. You asked if people, you know, if they liked the big band era, or if they... I always had trouble with it. It always seemed like a smoothing over of jazz. But the thing that really irritated me was the sense of the big band director, that one of the things about jazz was always this really free individuality, and you couldn't tell what was going to happen at any moment. And that gave way, kind of like in this, at the turn of the 1800s, the big orchestras came about and killed the groups of soloists.
Interesting, Larry. Thanks a lot for the call. So Larry's worried that you lost some of the individuality and some of the spontaneity when you took that small jazz act and turned it into a 17-piece band or whatever.
Well, I think that's a good argument, but I think the argument that would be in favor of the big bands would say that what you did is you substituted the arrangers who put that spontaneity, who put that improvisation, you'd say, into the music. They would write it out so that you were hearing a sense of improvisation. I heard many jazz performers play things that I didn't think were terribly improvised, that you knew they had picked up it by playing the solo over and over. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened with the big bands. They wrote out a lot of this improvisation. If you listen to a lot of Duke Ellington, you'll notice he might play a tune like Black and Tan Fantasy. He might have recorded it, well, I think he recorded it probably 12 or 15 times. But it's different many of the times, and that shows you the creativity that they brought to that thing. And some of the bands got stuck in a rut and played the same arrangements the same way every time. But the big bands opened up, as the terminology would have been it today, and they would say, okay, Harry James, you play a solo in this 32 bars, or Benny Goodman, you play your solo. And it would be totally improvised for that period of time.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to David in Elkhorn. David, hi.
Hi. I saw Duke Ellington at the Summerfest in the very early years at Miller Jazz Oasis. My girlfriend and I somehow ended up sitting on stage with a back against the PA system right about 8 feet from Duke Ellington. And nobody could see us from the audience. And Duke Ellington would play, and he'd be winking at her. And each time a soloist came out and got to the front to do a solo, they'd walk down across the stage, and they'd play right directly to her, looking her right in the eye. And nobody could see that from the audience. And
that's the story. David, you got to share a stage with Duke Ellington. Not many musicians can say that. had a story about Duke Ellington spending a week on the campus at UW-Madison.
This is about 1970, the university saw fit to bring Duke Ellington and his entire band to the campus for a week. And they played in every facility on campus that they could have. They played at the Union. They played at the stadium. They played in the field house. They played everywhere you could imagine. And it was just a wonderful experience. Plus, Duke and his band did daily clinics in the humanities building. And so that you got a chance to be right next to Duke Ellington as he was talking about the music. It was just a phenomenal experience, and it was there for a week. And as I think any of us that were there will never forget it.
Thanks a lot for calling and sharing that story. Back to your calls as we talk to Mike Lecrone about the big band era. He's teaching a class on it. Roger joins us from Milwaukee. Roger, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question, or two of my questions are, is how did some of these band members and band leaders get their nicknames, like Cozy Cole, Duke Ellington, Woody Herman, Count Basie, and are there any famous Wisconsin people besides Woody Herman who have nicknames for band leaders?
Roger, thanks. So first of all, we got a lot of nobility, the Counts and the Dukes out there.
Well, most people say that Duke Ellington started it, and he got that title mostly because he was such a dignified individual, and his real name is Edward Ellington, but Edward Kennedy Ellington, and people felt like this was a guy when he was on stage or when he was performing piano many times. He was a very elegant person, and so people started calling him Duke, and then it sort of crept out into other areas. Count Basie said that there's a Duke, and then there was a there ought to be a Count, and so it spread to a lot. The title thing got spread out to a lot of different people, and you know, Woody Herman, his obviously his real name is Woodrow, so that was
an easy one.
That was an easy one for them. And there were a lot of he mentioned Cozy Cole. Now, I don't know where that name came from, but my guess is that there's a lot of the names were playoffs on the person's original name. And I don't remember even what Cozy Cole's original name was, but it could have been something like Cosmo or something. Don't quote me on that one, but that's the way the names usually got. I mean, or sometimes they were Pee Wee Hunt was a famous band leader. Pee Wee Hunt was not very small. So it was kind of sometimes a lot of the band leaders got the name based on what they weren't as opposed to what they were.
And he had asked, any other names you want to drop apart from Woodrow Herman here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think, you know, it's been mentioned a couple of times, but there was a great trumpet player named Bunny Berrigan,
sure,
who was out of Fox Lake, Wisconsin. Bunny, again, his real name was Bernard, so it was kind of an easy transition to Bunny, but he was one of the great trumpet players of the era, and he was from Fox Lake and spent a lot of early years right here in Madison, playing at various venues around town.
Let's give a quick listen. Count Basie, you just mentioned, and Billie Holiday here, Swing Brothers Swing.
Deep rhythm captivates me. Hot rhythm stimulates me.
So talk about the role of the singers here in just our last few moments.
Well, the singers were sort of late comers in a way. They were almost incidental to the big bands. In the earliest days, Paul Whiteman had singers, one of whom was Bing Crosby, who later on...
he did okay.
Yeah, he took off on his own, but most of the time it was the singers came in, they did their chorus or a half chorus, and then they sat down, and that was the end of it. But then they started developing a personality. A lot of that happened during the Second World War when the manpower was hard to get, but some of the singers, Frank Sinatra, many people feel owe his fame to the fact that he was 4F, not eligible for the service, and so he got great popularity during that time during the war when a lot of the other people were being drafted and not being able to perform.
Well, Mike, we're out of time. Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
It went fast.
That's Mike Lecroe, and he was with us to talk about the big band era. The former UW Marching Band director is teaching a class on that topic at UW-Madison's Division of Continuing Studies. Find info at continuingstudies.wisc.edu. Stick around. More to come here on Central Time. There's an impeachment inquiry up and running in the House of Representatives. This isn't something we do very often. So it seems like it would make sense to look back at the few cases of impeachment we have tried to understand how it all works and learn lessons for the present day. But hold on. Our next guest is a historian who says the ghost of impeachment's past may not be able to tell us that much about the present and future. David Greenberg is a professor of history, journalism, and media studies at Rutgers University. He wrote about the lessons we can and can't learn from the history of impeachment in a piece in Politico. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
What are some of the hazards of using those past, two and a half impeachments, I guess, to try to learn lessons for today?
Right. Well, I'm all for people studying and knowing history. But it's dangerous to expect history to give us neat lessons, that we shouldn't expect something that unfolded in 1974 or 1998 will unfold similarly today. The situation with Trump is just too different from our previous impeachments. We've only had three, or as you say, two and a half impeachments, because Nixon quit before the machinery could really go into high gear. And so we have to be very gingerly and constrained in drawing hard and fast lessons from these past experiences.
In that piece in Politico, you kind of give a capsule summary of each of the impeachments and what was unique about them. I want to take a quick tour of those, and let's start with Andrew Johnson. It was a very different impeachment than the other ones we've seen.
Absolutely. I mean, Johnson, as listeners may know, became president only on the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. He was a Southerner from Tennessee who had been chosen by Lincoln as vice president as a sort of unity ticket, a union ticket, so that you could have North and South and Democrat and Republican represented on the same ticket. So he really represented a very different philosophy from Lincoln, and then basically got to warring with the radical Republicans in Congress over how the post-Civil War policy of Reconstruction, including civil rights for former slaves, should unfold. He was impeached really on some technicalities that I think most historians agree were not impeachable offenses. On the merits of policy, I think most people look back and would have sympathy with the Republicans in Congress who wanted a more generous extension of civil rights to Black Americans, who wanted a more aggressive policy of Reconstruction. But that's not what was up for debate. What was up for debate was whether he had violated certain laws and whether that really was an impeachable offense. And in the end, he just skated by with acquittal.
Okay, now, unless vampires are real, no one here today was there for Andrew Johnson. The other ones come back into lifetimes of some people listening. Richard Nixon, we hear a lot about Watergate. Those questions of legitimacy, should Nixon have been impeached and would he have been impeached? How do you apply those in that case of Watergate?
Right. So in the Johnson case, I look at sort of the separate questions of constitutionality. Were the grounds there for impeachment? And also political questions. Was it possible to remove him? In Johnson, you could say, well, maybe there were grounds, and certainly it was possible. With Nixon, definitely there were grounds for impeachment, and definitely it was possible. You had a Republican Party that was very different from today's, where both a lot of liberal Republicans, a phrase we don't hear too much these days, but you know, Wisconsin used to have a number of these, and some very conservative Republicans like Barry Goldwater or James Buckley, the senator from New York, who was the brother of William F. Buckley, the conservative journalist. They were very hard on Nixon and in favor of his impeachment or resignation. And so you had much more flexibility within the parties than you see today. And so Nixon, who, of course, committed a number of constitutional crimes, abuses of power, obstruction of justice, denying congressional subpoenas. It convinced lots of Republicans that it was time for him to go.
And then the final case study is Bill Clinton. How does that meet those two standards?
So in Clinton's case, you had an impeachment charge that was not constitutionally justified. And also, that was never going to happen, or almost never. I mean, it was pretty apparent from early on that the Monica Lewinsky affair, which was at the core of the impeachment charge and Clinton's responses, lying in response to questions about it, did not rise to the level, as people took to saying, of high crimes and misdemeanors, which is the constitutional standard for impeachment. And it was recognized from quite early on that it was a very partisan affair. Very few Democrats supported it. Not too many Republicans opposed it, although it was significant that when the impeachment trial did go to the Senate, after the Republican-controlled House did impeach Clinton, a number of Republican senators voted no on various counts. There were four counts that were brought. And the fact that you couldn't even get all the Republicans and you could get zero Democrats showed, I think, what many people felt all along, that it was a very partisan affair from the beginning. It had grown out of the Whitewater investigation, which was a real estate deal that Clinton had participated in while still governor of Arkansas, and it had somehow morphed into an investigation of his sex life. And I think the public and most political observers, although not necessarily the Washington media, felt that while Clinton certainly didn't acquit himself personally, he deserved to be acquitted under the standards of constitutional law.
Talking to historian David Greenberg from Rutgers University, he wrote a piece that says it may be hard to draw lessons from impeachment's past to look at what's going on today. But we might have some precedents set. I want to give a listen to current Senator Lindsey Graham. Back in 1999, he was, I think, a House manager for impeachment. Here's a pair of clips from him from the same speech that CNN played back to back.
You don't even have to be convicted of a crime to lose your job in this constitutional republic. If this body determines that your conduct as a public official is clearly out of bounds in your role, impeachment is about cleansing the office. Impeachment is about restoring honor and integrity to the office.
David, do you see potentially people looking back to arguments made in the Clinton impeachment and the Nixon almost impeachment to justify actions today in the Trump impeachment effort?
Well, sure. And a lot of people are going to be looking, as Senator Graham seems to appear, a bit hypocritical. The problem is that the two men are accused of very different things. One is accused of covering up a sexual encounter, and one is accused of encouraging a foreign nation to intervene with our democratic processes. The fact that there's such different alleged crimes or wrongdoings makes those comparisons, I think, of, you know, relatively little value. The other thing I think Senator Graham said that's sort of mistaken is to say, well, you don't have to be convicted of a crime. It harkens back to a famous claim by Gerald Ford that you could be impeached for whatever the House and Senate at a given moment in time deem impeachable. Now, that is technically true, but what they are doing is losing sight of, you know, what they call the is-ought distinction, what Congress can do and what Congress should do. Of course, it's possible to impeach someone on specious grounds if you simply have the votes to do it. But we don't really think our government should work that way. We think that you should only be impeached for what the Constitution specifies as high crimes and misdemeanors. So then we have to debate whether covering up an affair is a high crime or misdemeanor. Most people would say no. Or whether Trump's actions in the case of Ukraine or perhaps some of the other previous questions relating to the 2016 election amount to high crimes and misdemeanors. And that certainly, at the least, is an open debate.
We're talking to Professor David Greenberg from Rutgers, where he teaches history and journalism and media studies. He says past cases of impeachment may not teach us much about what's happening today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you were following the Nixon or Clinton impeachment efforts at the time, what do you remember? Did you experience both of them? You want to compare and contrast? Do you have comparisons to the modern day, or do you have a question for our guest about all this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with historian and journalism professor David Greenberg from Rutgers. We're talking about the lessons we can take away from past impeachments, or not, as we are in uncharted waters with the current impeachment process. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Well, one unique element, of course, is, as you were touching on, President Trump himself. He was on the White House lawn this morning taking questions. He mentioned an upcoming meeting with the Chinese on trade next week and then reiterated his recommendations for Ukraine's government.
They should investigate the Bidens, because how does a company that's newly formed and all these companies, if you look at, and by the way, likewise, China should start an investigation into the Bidens, because what happened in China is just about as bad as what happened with Ukraine.
So we got this weird case where Democrats are saying asking foreign governments to intervene in the election and to target your political opponent is an impeachable offense, and the president responding by doing it again and then bringing another country into the mix. What do you make of this, David?
Well, it really does show how Trump, as you say, is a unique element in this. I mean, when we heard Richard Nixon on the tapes, we saw a side of him that is kind of like Trump, you know, foul-mouthed, petty, talking like a gangster. The difference is Trump talks this way in public. Nixon tried very hard to conceal that, to project an image that he was dignified and statesmanlike and honest and upstanding. And then people learned that it was something of a lie. With Trump, it's all out there in the open. And I think he has a very different approach, which is to figure that the people who are with him are going to be cheered by this, and the people who are against him are already against him, and so it can't get any worse. I think that's sort of a dangerous game, even though, you know, you could argue it's worked for him so far.
Let's bring on a caller. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi. My question was that on previous impeachments of both Nixon and President Clinton, is that the opposing political side was involved in the impeachment, including the ability to subpoena witnesses and also to look for, like, in part of the fact finding. That doesn't appear to be applicable right now, that it's all being controlled only by one party. And I was wondering if that's going to make the impeachment party more polarizing than whether or not President Trump really did do something wrong.
Charlie, thanks for the call. He's saying there were bipartisan efforts on the subpoenas and things like that, David.
Well, I think certainly on the Nixon impeachment proceedings, and before that, the Senate hearings, you had at least, you know, a significant portion of the Republicans who were supportive. You know, in the Clinton case, it was very different. There was really very little Democratic support for the whole undertaking, and it was driven by Newt Gingrich and Henry Hyde, working pretty closely with Ken Starr, who, of course, though an independent counsel, was a very partisan Republican as well. So in that case, I think the partisanship of the undertaking hurt the Republicans' cause. And famously, Newt Gingrich lost seats in a rare event in the 1998 midterm elections. I do think the Democrats are going to have a hard row to hoe if they can't get Republican support. And I personally see very little prospect of that. So I do think, even if people feel that this is justified, and I think there's a strong case that impeachment is justified, it's not politically possible. I mean, it's impossible to impeach him in the House because the Democrats have the number, but it won't be possible to convict him in the Senate. And I think a lot of people will see that and wonder why the Democrats are going through this process. So I think there are some political hazards for them.
Time for one more quick call. Samantha is with us in Whitehall. Samantha, hi.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, what's the purpose of impeaching Trump now at this point in time when the elections are coming up so fast? Whether he did what they're accusing him of or not is irrelevant to the point of why are they doing it now.
Samantha, thanks a lot for the call. Don't have a lot of time left. David, some Democrats have said because the president, they argue, is trying to interfere in those elections.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think also in 2016, when there was evidence of Trump trying to interfere in that election, President Obama didn't do much. He told Putin of Russia to cut it out because he assumed Trump was going to lose and Hillary Clinton would win. I think the Democrats, when they saw Trump doing something similar, felt they couldn't take the same path again. They couldn't follow the same script again. If they were going to make a mistake, it would be better to be caught trying, as people say. So I think it was, you know, there are risks either way. And I think the argument the caller makes is, one with some legitimacy. But either course was going to have some political perils, and I think they felt they couldn't simply replay the script of 2016 and wait till Election Day.
David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
That's David Greenberg, professor of history, journalism, and media studies at Rutgers University. We talked to him today about the history of impeachment and what it can and can't tell us about the future of the current impeachment inquiry. As hospital closings continue in rural America, lots of people are looking for solutions. One Missouri program is immersing university students in small-town life. It aims to lure more medical professionals to go rural. Side Effects Public Media's Sebastian Martinez Valdivia reports.
It's a hot and sunny afternoon in Sedalia, Missouri, a town between St. Louis and Kansas City. Jennifer and Matt Boatwright are escorting some unusual visitors into a pasture on their farm.
Because we don't just turn the animals loose.
They opened the heavy gate and called the sheep over to meet a half dozen medical students from the University of Missouri system. The farm tour is part of a week-long program designed to introduce future doctors, pharmacists, and nurses to rural life. They meet local leaders, businesses, and healthcare providers. The goal, to get students interested in working in rural areas.
To understand what their role is, not only as a healthcare provider in the medical community, but what their role is as a healthcare provider in a community at large.
That's Kathleen Quinn, Associate Dean for Rural Health at the School of Medicine. The university offers other opportunities for students to work alongside rural providers, but Quinn says the immersion program gives students a picture of life in a small town. That's one of Beth Everett's goals, as well as the director of recruitment for Bothwell Regional Health Center.
We have to make sure when they do come to visit us that they walk away saying that was such a friendly area and everyone there was so nice and they can see themselves living and working here.
Everett says most residency programs are in much bigger cities, so it can be hard for new doctors to imagine living in a rural town of 20,000 like Sedalia. She's recruited people from all over, but one thing that can help is when prospective employees have ties to the area.
Sometimes they're from Missouri or Kansas City or nearby, and they want to come back to this area to be closer to family, whether they've been out or whether they've been in training.
Researchers say that's one of the most effective ways to recruit healthcare providers to rural areas. They call it the Grow Your Own strategy, developing a pipeline for prospective doctors and nurses from as early as middle school.
Many rural youth leave because of lack of opportunity.
Michael Meat is a researcher who focuses on health disparities between rural and urban areas. He says there's a misconception that all young people from rural areas want to leave.
I think most people, given the opportunity, are proud of their communities, are proud of their history. They want to be near their family and friends.
Magdaleno Gutierrez isn't from the area, but he's sold on rural life. The second-year medical student hails from Los Angeles, but his family comes from rural Mexico, and he says he's deeply aware of rural health needs.
I mean, not having practitioners in a rural community can make or break a rural community. And personally, my grandmother had treatable diabetes that she passed away from really early in her life due to just not having access to health care.
Gutierrez already had an interest in becoming a rural provider, but he says meeting so many community members increased his commitment.
I just haven't had that opportunity to see behind the curtain and really get to know these individuals who will hopefully be my patients one day and get to understand and know them on a deeper level.
The University of Missouri recently received $5 million in federal grants to expand its Rural Track Pipeline program. That includes scholarships for students from rural areas and opportunities for students to do rotations at rural hospitals. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Sebastian Martinez Valdivia.
Tomorrow, our series looks at creative efforts to preserve Wisconsin's rural hospitals. These reports are part of a collaboration of 12 newsrooms, including Wisconsin Public Radio, and led by Iowa Watch and the Institute for Nonprofit News, with additional support from the Solutions Journalism Network. For more, visit hospitals.iowawatch.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there's been a lot of immigration news under the radar this week amid all the impeachment stuff going on. We'll get the latest from new restrictions on refugees to some of the latest court rulings. Native tribal members from around the country could be eligible for in-state tuition at UW schools under a proposal in the state legislature. We'll talk to a lawmaker behind that proposal. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday with pizza. And not just any pizza. Our guest will unlock the secrets of a perfect pan pizza. I think we're going to get some Sicilian style along the way. You can get some advice and recipes and share your favorites. And if you have a pizza making secret, you can get started right now. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.